Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in Latino Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm David James Gonzalez, the host of this conversation, and I'm pleased to be speaking with Romeo Guzman, Stacy Macias, and Daniel Morales about their new anthology, East of East, The Making of Greater El Monte, published by Rutgers University Press in 2020. Romeo Guzman received his PhD in Latin American history from Columbia University. From 2016 to 2020, he was an assistant professor at California State University, Fresno, where he founded and directed the Valley Public History Initiative. With Caribbean Fragosa, Guzman is co-director of the South El Monte Arts Posse and co-director of Boom California. Beginning in the fall of 2020, Guzman will join the history faculty at Claremont Graduate University. Stacy Macias is an assistant professor in the Department of Women's, Gender, and Sexuality Studies at California State University, Long Beach. She earned a PhD in Women's Studies from UCLA. Her research and teaching are in feminist of color knowledge production, feminist transnational activisms, and queer of color cultural politics, including queer femme aesthetics, butch femme desire, and queer of color counterpublics. She grew up in South El Monte, California, and is co-founding member of the Los Angeles-based Tongues, a queer, lesbian, and bisexual women of color project and zine. Daniel Morales is from Azusa, California, and is an assistant professor of history at James Madison University, soon to move to Virginia Commonwealth University. He earned his PhD in history from Columbia University and BA from the University of Chicago. His research focuses on the history of migration between Latin America and the United States, including the immigrant Harrisonburg Public History Project. His upcoming book, Entre Aquí y Allá, Creating the Political Economy of Transnational Mexican Migration, 1900 to 1942, examines the creation of transnational migratory networks across Mexico and the United States in the 20th century. All right. Hello, Romeo, Stacy, and Daniel, and welcome to New Books in Latino Studies.
Thank you. Hello.
Thanks very much.
Well, it's great to have all three of you with us, and the three of you just represent really, I mean, a small sample of the tremendous amount of work and contributors to this anthology. So I guess where I'd like to begin is with the origins of the project, and I'll turn to you, Romeo, as one of the co-editors. Your other editors are Caribbean Fragosa, right, Alex Cummings, and Ryan Reft. If you can tell us a bit, just to get us started on how this really kind of big and project came together.
Yeah, so it's kind of a long story, and I guess I'll start at the beginning, which is that the book really originates from the South El Monte Arts Posse. And the South El Monte Arts Posse is a loose collection of artists, writers, educators, uncles, tias, cousins that are interested in essentially doing social arts practice. So we're making art with and for community, and most importantly, using art to think about our place and how we navigate place and who has ownership to place. So that's all to say that the story is very simple, is that SEMAP was founded in 2010 by Carmen Fragosa, who's my partner. And since then, her and I have co-edited it together, or co-directed it together. And a really simple thing happens. In 2012, El Monte is celebrating its centennial anniversary. And as part of that centennial anniversary, as part of celebrating 100 years, one of the big myths or the big ideas of the city is that it's the end of the Santa Fe Trail, right? So for the last 100 years, it's promoted this myth, it's sold this myth, and it's told this story about El Monte's place in the West, about El Monte's place in California. And we were really sort of troubled by that, by this idea that the history of El Monte could be sort of codified or reduced to one single origin story, right? And then we could talk more about why that was problematic. But for us, we knew that, A, that history was very narrow. We soon found out that it was not just narrow, but historically incorrect. And what we did is we used that starting point, 2012, this 10-year anniversary, as a sort of entry point to sort of tell a new history and to essentially build this project, which was called, and at its origins, East of East, Mapping Community Narratives in El Monte and South El Monte. And this project was really a public history project. And it was unique because it was a collaboration between CEMAP and La Casa del Hijo Ladwisote, which is an archive in Mexico City. And the founder of La Casa project is Diego Flores Magón, who's a good friend of ours. And there was a couple different connections here. One was that, Ricardo Flores Magón gave a famous speech in El Monte in 1917. And he wasn't in El Monte a long time, but he was there for a little bit. So in some ways, right, this history of this radical anarchist in El Monte provided a different entry point from, say, the pioneers, from this white narrative, from this very nationalist perspective. But the other really important thing was that even though we were doing different things in different places, we were both sort of wrestling with similar questions. For CEMAP, the big question was, how do we use the arts to think about place? How do we democratize access to the arts? How do we democratize access to public space? And for Diego at La Casa, he was essentially taking Enrique Flores Magón's archive, using it to reactivate a place that had been deserted, right? And really thinking about how do we create a new archive? So for him, the question was, he has these historical papers and he's going to build an archive. And how does he create an archive that's alive, that's basically not, that's sort of going against the bureaucracy of an archive? So for him, the question was, what are the radical possibilities of an archive? So what we did, and this was kind of cool, we applied to a grant from LA City Department of Cultural Affairs. At the time, they had this really cool grant where if you were an artist in LA, you could apply for money to go travel abroad and do an art project abroad. And if you were an artist, an international artist, you could apply to come to LA to work with an organization in LA to do some sort of art project. So we pitched to LA City Department of Cultural Affairs an art project that essentially involved an arts collective and an archive in Mexico City. And the idea was that we were going to build a new archive using storytelling, and we were going to reimagine what an archive is and how an archive works. And again, using this 1917 point as a point of departure and as a point of entry into this sort of history of El Monte. So that's kind of the origins of the project. And I can talk a little bit more about how it evolves, but perhaps that's a good place to start.
Yeah, no, great. Thank you for that. I mean, I'm really fascinated by the sense that this is, this art collective is where this originates and what brings so many of you all together. Can you just talk a bit more? I mean, there are, as far as if I counted correctly, 31 contributors to this anthology. There's roughly 31, I think about 31 short essays as well. I don't think that accounts for, that doesn't account for the introduction. Could you just add a bit more about, essentially you kind of explained, so is that this grant, did you use this grant, to essentially create a call, for people to contribute? Or again, how did you essentially cast this net and get 31 people all committed to, adding something to the history of Greater El Monte?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. So what happened is Diego Flores Magón and Ferdinand Enciso represented La Casa, and myself, Caribbean, and Jennifer Anteria were CEMAP. And we actually got lucky in the sense that my mom was renting a house at that time period. She lives in it now. And the renters were going to move out. So there was this month period where the house was going to be empty. So we essentially lived together for 4 weeks. The homies from La Casa and the CEMAP homies. And our kid was born, Aura was born. So Aura was living with us too. And that first 4 weeks was really the origin to the project. But the project evolved and grew for the next 8 years. And what we did is throughout the process, we ended up developing a model for public history. But one of the ways in which I can sort of talk about how it is that we got contributors is that we would have an event about something that we knew. So for example, we would have an event about the barrios, right, which Danny will talk about. And then we would collect oral histories and we would maybe give a talk or host a conversation. And as we started building this archive, we started finding stories that we either knew about or that when you had to be written out. And then we started inviting folks to contribute based on the material that we had. So in some ways, the process of inviting collaborators in many ways grew with the archive. As we started finding more stories, we started asking people if they would contribute. And then usually what would happen is once people did write an essay, right? So Nick Jervik, for example, some of the Columbia folks, Maria John, Andre Decro, Daniel Morales, once they had completed an essay, they would come to El Monte, they would collect moral histories, they would give a talk, and we would structure the talk in a way that it was open. In other words, we would sort of present it as almost like a work in progress, right? This is what we know about this particular aspect of El Monte, South El Monte history. And after that, we would invite folks to do oral histories to bring documents with them that we would scan, and that we would sort of continue to build the archive. And then we would dish those back to the authors, which would often revise what they had written based on some of this stuff. So in some ways, you know, the project starts with that initial LA City Department of Cultural Affairs grant, but it grows and evolves in a lot of really unique ways that allow us to do this. And in some cases, we didn't do a lot of work. And what I mean by that is in some cases, the authors themselves went out and found the archive. And this is the case with Stacey Macias. We knew that we had done a good job of gender, right? That we had covered that pretty well. Or we felt that we covered it pretty well. You guys can, you know, the readers can obviously disagree with us. But we also knew that we had heard about the Sugar Shack, and we knew that if we didn't have it in there, that was going to be a huge hole, right? And a big missed opportunity. So we asked her if she could take that on. And to her credit, she found the folks to interview, and she did a lot of that legwork. There's other cases like that too. But for the most part, right, this was a sort of very collaborative experience in which we tried to pick folks that we thought would be good to write this essay. And perhaps what's also unique is if you look through some of the table of contents or the author bios, a lot of the folks that contributed were coming from Columbia. And part of that was the fact that I was at Columbia. Danny was at Columbia. Ryan Reft did his MA at Columbia. Alex, you know, she got her PhD at Columbia. So in that sense, there was a sort of a huge spirit of collaboration with my cohort and folks above and below me at Columbia, I should be careful here. I think that can be rare in grad school, right? This idea that you're collaboratively building something together, particularly at a place that can often be very competitive. So that's kind of how we got these contributors.
Great. Well, I mean, I just love the idea that, you know, the whole public history initiative, the desire to really expand the archive to, you know, and to create an archive to begin this, you know, form of more expansive type of, you know, knowledge production that engages with the community and brings community academia together. There's journalists, right? There's artists all involved in this. I mean, there's a word that, or a phrase I think that's used in the introduction that's, disciplinary kind of promiscuity promiscuous in that way. So I think we use the term a lot, you know, either interdisciplinary or intersectional, but I mean, that just real intensive and meaningful effort to bring in different styles, different skill sets, different perspectives, all under, again, this effort at public history and knowledge production, archive creation. I'm wondering, you know, Stacey and Daniel, if each of you, if you wouldn't mind, could you tell us, perhaps beginning with Stacey, your connection and, you know, introduction to this project?
Sure. So Romeo and Caribbean approached me, like Romeo said. I wasn't a part of that beautiful process, which I actually learned a lot learned a lot about the process, Romeo. So thank you for explaining some of that history. I was not a grad student at Columbia, so I don't have those kinds of connections with folks. But it was, I think, you know, I met Caribbean actually when I was a grad student at UCLA. And so I happened to have attended one of the CMOP events, and my partner, who is much more active on social media, had seen this announcement. At the time, I was living in Las Vegas, teaching at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas there. And one of the times that I was in town happened to coincide with one of the events that they were hosting. She invited me, and lo and behold, it was this collective. And I thought, this is wild. It's South El Monte is in its name. And as someone who grew up in South El Monte, my dad worked across the street actually from where that event was held when it used to be, I think it was a Chinese restaurant. And I went off to school. I actually did my undergrad at a small women's college in Lynchburg, Virginia, then came home, tried to establish, you know, life here, and did UCLA grad school. Working within South El Monte as a place, thinking about it critically as a space, didn't ever come into my horizon of possibilities around doing research and work. I think a lot of people who are queer and of color, we leave our communities. And so to find this space, to see what they were offering through this artistic and musical and poetic blending of cultural arts was really exciting. So I think in part, that's how some of the connections started, and also via the earlier connection that I had with Caribbean. They reached out to me and asked me if I would write this story. And like I said, it hadn't really dawned on me that I would think about writing something that was almost like it was too close, right? Growing up, you know, within a few miles of the Sugar Shack, which is the name of the lesbian gay bar that I write about, it didn't dawn on me. And so they were both very helpful, Romeo and Caribbean, and hooking me up with the city clerk's office. And in particular, they had a few contacts there because obviously they had been working in a capacity formally with the city. So getting that sort of infrastructure and insight into the city's holdings, the city's official records, was really crucial to being able to build this narrative, and then working with finding folks through social networking sites like Facebook. As I said, I'm not a big social network user, but I found such value in accessing social networking sites. That is what led me to the person who became my main contact then, who opened the door to all these other contacts. Curiously, her name is Shelley Ponce. She's from San Gabriel Valley, went to Garfield, is very local, remains here. Curiously, she is not someone who identifies as queer or lesbian or gay, but she was very much ensconced in these communities because of her love of music and fashion. And so she connected me with a group of people who are related who are friends with her sister. And or two of her sisters, actually, if I'm remembering correctly, who both identify as lesbian and or bisexual. So she was really the key to being able to connect the oral stories, or the stories that come from the personal reflections, the memory recollections, sort of those embodied narratives that you get outside of the official city records and record keeping. So pairing those together was really the work that I did, both enabled by Romeo and Caribbean and then my one contact, Shelley, to build out this story, which ended up being much more exciting and rich and full than I had imagined, and has actually opened up some other what I've built relationships with people along the way, and also has led me to more insight and information about other little known bars, clubs, spaces that existed once upon a time in South El Monte, El Monte, and other east of east locales. I could say more but about the actual content of the piece, but I'll pause and see if you have any question.
Great. No, thank you for that. Yeah, we'll get into the piece in just a little bit more in a little bit more detail in a bit. Thank you. Daniel, your background, your connection, and introduction to this project.
All right. Actually, through this project, I ended up learning a lot more about my own family's connection to El Monte. I knew that my family had lived there in the 70s and 80s, but I had mostly grown up in Azusa. So through this project, I found that my family had been in the city since the 1920s, something that I didn't know before this project started. That was part of interviewing my own family and figuring out, linking a lot of the documentary records with sort of what I could find out by asking around. I first learned of the project, I'm not entirely sure when I first learned of the project. Somewhere around 2012, 2013, Romeo started working on this, and he asked me to come help him. And at the time, he was already living in Southern California, and I was in New York, but I would visit my family every school break, come spend the time in California. So he wanted me to help him out with this. And so I agreed to do it. Around the same time, Columbia received a good amount of money from the AHA as part of a project to increase different types of skill levels and to do the non-traditional historical projects. At Columbia, the money ended up being used student-run. Students would propose projects that would then be put forward. And so I proposed a public history grant to go and do oral history interviews and work with community members as part of CEMAP. And I got the grant. And over the next couple of years, we got three or four more small grants from that project, from Columbia, and then from other sources at Columbia University that allowed different graduate students there and many others to work, to come to Los Angeles and work on this project. And many others volunteered their time and worked for free for the project. Building off of earlier records, he asked me to write these this story on Hicks Camp. So I went on try to find a lot of what the historical what existed in records, and so that meant going to the there's a large oral history project that had been done at one of the colleges at Whittier, right next to El Monte, as well as the Robert Beals papers and various other projects that had been done in the mid-20th century and early 20th century. And a lot of those included interviews from people who lived in El Monte at the time. So based on these, as well as other records, I put together the original version of the essay. As Romeo mentioned earlier, these essays often were then presented to community members. And I certainly got a lot of pushback, correctly so, from that, because I was way too reliant on the official record in building these. And I think it showed the importance of going back to communities and working with communities when working with this historical material. Part of that also meant going to the two museums, working with La Historia, the Historical Society, La Historia Historical Society in El Monte, and the official El Monte Historical Society, which is right next to it, which is a museum that paints a very pioneer version of the history of El Monte. And we did an interview with the curator of the museum, in which the curator described this as the first all-American town, almost uncritically, right? Which is one of the things that we wanted to push back on in this essay, and writing an alternative version of the history, and often building off of the work that many people had been doing themselves. Like he sort of was a collection of mostly Mexican people who had grown up in the city, and having seen that, wanted to preserve their own history and not being part of the official history. They created their own society and their own institution, which is about a block away now. And that really became sort of the ground floor of the project, working with La Historia and then working with community members. We would get grants to bring in other graduate students from Columbia, but other institutions as well. And they would spend time in these community events. We would have events where we would bring in as trying to invite as many members of the community as possible, work with institutions to do so. So work with La Historia, work with schools, work with senior citizen centers, or work with arts collectives. And we would have these events that would be geared towards different communities in and around the city and in different sites and around the city. Afterwards, we would do interviews. So we would get recording equipment and sit down with people. Over the next couple of months, we ended up collecting dozens of interviews. I would say close to 100 interviews overall. Eventually, this became the archive, which is we applied for money to make an online archive. And so we've built a website around which you can go and see a lot of the interviews that the writers of the book use going forward.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for that. While both you and Stacy were speaking, I'm thinking more of, for our non-Southern California, audience, what may be going through their mind is, where is El Monte or El Mani, right? Why El Mani? Why a book? Why a book on El Mani? And to be all of which that case had to have been made at some point. I mean, beyond a public history project, which is how this originates, which is wonderful. This is published by, a academic university press. And so in several ways, you kind of have to make an argument for the significance of this place that is, most definitely not very well known for people outside of Southern California, right? Just any thoughts or comments on that? Maybe beginning with you, Romeo. Why should people, see this as significant? What story does this tell that is both unique to El Monte, but then also, important and part of the bigger kind of history of the region?
Yeah, so perhaps I'll start with a confession, right? Which is that, we always said that El Monte matters, right? And if you go to El Monte, people have a lot of pride, and it's sort of this underdog pride, and they understand that they're important, but they maybe can't articulate it in a sort of academic sense, or maybe even just a regular sense, right? So we went into this project with the argument that El Monte mattered. And we knew that El Monte mattered because of the scholarship, right? Matt Garcia's stuff on Legion Stadium, Deborah Weber, Gonzalez on Berry Strike. So there was these clear moments in El Monte history where El Monte became a flashpoint for LA history, for SoCal history. So there are these moments in the historiography where you see that El Monte matters. And we had a hunch that El Monte mattered beyond those moments, or perhaps a better way to put that is that if El Monte mattered in 33, if El Monte mattered in, post-World War II with Legion Stadium, if El Monte mattered with Toypurina, even though it wasn't called El Monte then, right? There had to be something that's connecting these moments together. And what we ended up finding out was that El Monte, and this is where the project, the title comes from, right, is east of East LA, but that it's really sort of a place in which all these different radical politics, both right and left, are being imagined and enacted, and a way in which they're connected to LA, to East LA, and provide a sort of entry point into the rest of the San Gabriel Valley and to the Inland Empire. So in that sense, part of the argument of the book is that you can't really understand LA without understanding El Monte, and that El Monte has been important throughout these 300 years for the history of SoCal, for the history of Los Angeles. And I think Stacy Macias's piece makes a really clear argument around that, but I'll just give you one example, right, which is the El Monte Boys. you can't really talk about 19th century California, 19th century LA, SoCal without talking about the El Monte Boys, which are essentially folks from the South that bring this very Southern violence and then enact it upon people of color. And they're essentially mob violence, right? But they become sort of romanticized and heroicized throughout the 20th century. And they become these sort of like pioneer-like figures. But at the end of the day, they represent the violence that was used to create sort of white supremacy, but also to sort of wrestle control from the early settlers. So I think the argument here is that you can't understand the history of LA without the history of El Monte. And you can, people can fight me on that, and that's okay, but Austin, read the book first.
Yeah, no, definitely. You know, I'm struck. I'm going to ask you know, both Stacy and Daniel to speak on this as well. But I mean, I just loved it. I love that argument. I really appreciate, right, going into a project of, you know, that this space and this place matters. And, you know, but it takes a lot of work. You know, it takes a lot of effort to actually help people see that. And, you know, just how this project formed, I think, is gone around at all the right steps. I'm reminded of, you know, something that's mentioned in the introduction, something that I think about a lot, particularly my teaching of history to my students, is teaching them the power, right, of historical narratives, and that we think people and places matter because we're told that, you know, we're told by people whose interpretations and narratives get a lot of, you know, play. And it's not to say that those places aren't, but I think it's to say that, you know, it takes people taking that stance and saying, you know, this place does matter. It matters not just for the people that live there, but it also matters, you know, beyond that. You know, there's an importance, you know, both of the local and to, you know, the global, I think, of each place and of people. I think that is a politic I'll, you know, acknowledge of, you know, in history. That's a, you know, luckily I was trained by people that helped me to see that, but it's definitely something I very much appreciate. But I think it's an important thing to note and bring out that you know, that power of historical narratives and why we believe and think things matter is often because we're told they do, right? And then that's repeated, right, so often. And so definitely, I mean, I'm in the camp El Monte matters, and I think this is just a phenomenal, you know, step at you know, expanding on, as you've already mentioned, right, moments of history that we do know, like the El Monte Berry strike, the, you know, El Monte Boys, etc. But you know, Stacy, Daniel, your thoughts on kind of this discussion on why El Monte matters?
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yes, I think El Monte is sort of the center of Southern California, but you don't think of it as the center of California, right? Think of urban Los Angeles, or other parts. A lot of the specific work that I was trying to do in my essays link El Monte to the other places. That meant explaining how you get the particular economy in the early 20th century of mixed urban agricultural, but also industrial, how migrations are linked to why people went there in large numbers in the early 20th century, but how those migrations are changing Southern California, changing this, the Southwest, changing Mexico at the same time, how you end up with a system of colonias, not just in Southern California, but across California and across the Southwest, where Mexicans are working in these unincorporated communities that often predate the traditional city or suburbs that later displaced them. And it goes further back, right? The early essays on Spanish colonialism, indigenous revolt, show that this is the place in which many of the themes of California and American history are playing out, and they're playing out in very particular ways in these particular spaces. See, it's a place that is both the subject of history, where various movements come, or global movements, or in global industrialization, global migration, are shaping this particular place. But it's also a place where people are coming and shaping their own destinies, right? Organizing for the Mexican Revolution, or organizing for strikes, or organizing for the Chicano movement in the 60s, or organizing for change in the most recent period. That all history is a both national and international, but the ways in which it happens and the ways you explain it is through the local, right? That it often you can't explain national or international currents without having a good sense of local history.
Great. Thank you. That's a great point. Stacy?
Sure. I would make the case too that El Monte matters and South El Monte matters as well, both because they're distinct cities that have there's a relationship between them, but they also are separate cities that often get conflated into one. And as a South El Monte native, I would make that case alongside Romeo's case and the book's whole case as well. You know, that what's interesting about the title of the book, East of East, is that it reminds us that there are sites, there are locations, there are places and spaces beyond the juggernaut of East LA. And I think in East LA in the imaginary, right now, this mythic historic place that gets, maybe some East LA haters or I would get accused of being an East LA hater by now saying that it has solidified its presence in the public imagination, definitely in the Latino, Latina immigrant imagination locally, and I would say nationally as well, and transnationally. So I think when we think of East LA, we can definitely see the relationship to these other suburban, working class, highly diverse, multicultural, multi-ethnic communities, but making a claim to them and prioritizing them as a subject of study is what validates them and elevates their presence and their importance. So the East of East that title reminds us of is that there is a particular presence to East LA and Boyle Heights and all the neighboring communities that have occupied our imagination and actually now occupy our public and pop cultural production. I was thinking about the importance of the representation of these sites and places and the people within them historically and contemporaneously, and at the same time that they become so locked or ossified in their representation that there's no out to it. So if anybody knows that show Vida on Stars, or if we know Gentified, we see these conversations now happening around gentrification in these communities And it's so important for these conversations and these representations to ascend into the mainstream. And at the same time, what they do is they become mythic, that the communities that exist in and around them that have specific relationships to them get lost or get buried. And so this is, you know, one of the reasons why I think the communities east of east, and why that title is so, why it just really resonates as something powerful, that what is east of east? What is outside of that juggernaut?
Oh, thank you for that. I really appreciate that insight. And I wanted to take a few minutes, maybe if we can, is to, you know, dive a bit deeper into each of the chapters that Daniel and Stacy contributed. Maybe we'll start with Daniel's chapter on Hicks Camp. My thinking was, so Daniel, if you can tell us what do you learn in the process of, you know, writing about Hicks Camp? You know, what I was struck with is how similar the story of Hicks Camp is to, you know, barrio formation and, you know, ethnic Mexican Latino community formation, you know, pretty much all throughout Southern California. I mean, as I'm reading that, I'm thinking of my, you know, the place that I study, which is Orange County, and there's a very similar narrative to how so many of those colonias and barrios form there. But I also, you know, in my readings, I was thinking about San Bernardino, I was thinking about Riverside, I was thinking about Ventura County. You know, there are colonias and communities that are in all those places where you know, Hicks Camp seems to be very representative of, you know, not only the Mexican-American, Latina, or Latinx experience in Southern California, but also, you know, how this is a part of, you know, urbanization in Southern California that in the academic literature is covered to some extent, but it is still not as well understood. You know, when we talk about urban formation, urbanization in Southern California, it's, you know, those of us within Latino and Latinx studies understand the contribution, but it's still, I think, in the greater narrative of Los Angeles, of Southern California, the significance of colonias and barrios and the process that described in your story of Hicks Camps isn't, again, is underappreciated and often ignored. Your thoughts, Daniel?
I think that's absolutely true. This book is both a work of Latinx studies, a work of history, a book that's trying to bring issues of culture and history to the table, but it's also steeped in the world of urban history as well. And while there's been work by Latino scholars on explaining California and explaining this process of, we talk about colonias, that hasn't made much of an impact in the world of urban history. If you look at works, even very recent works, there's still this dominant theme of the city, urban landscapes, and the suburbs, right? Or the suburbs and redevelopment come in and destroy, almost as if there wasn't anything there before. And in doing so, I think they really do a violence to the history, adding to the type of violence that ended up destroying so many of these colonias across the landscape of California. This particular camp, we chose it because it was the site of the ferry strike of 1933. But we also use it as a stand-in for both the colonias of El Monte and for this larger phenomena of these agricultural colonias more broadly. This camp wasn't unique, and it deals with the segregation that was endemic in the city of El Monte, where for the most part, Mexicans were excluded from buying homes in the city proper. Instead, most of the workers who came to labor on the farms that went to the city went to these unincorporated at colonias. These were unregulated towns, often on private property. In the case of Hicks Camp, others were on public property. These were not officially part of the city, not officially incorporated, which meant no official city services. These were camps where people came to work there with the intention that they would leave. A lot of these camps were not originally created to be permanent housing, but they became permanent housing. You see this in the case of Hicks Camp, where the population of the camp could go as low as about 300 or 400 in the off season to as high as 1,500 at the peak of harvest, a pattern that repeated itself from the 1910s through the 1940s and 1950s. This camp was even still home to a major organizing effort. This is something that, in theory, shouldn't happen in the world of labor history. Often people talk about site-specific organizing, that you can't that it takes being in a particular place to create the particular types of solidarities that are needed for people to organize around a union and go for a strike. That wasn't the case at Hicks Camp or the neighboring camps or the other camps in these areas, where a lot of the people would move in and out, where the population was somewhat different every single season from year to year. Likewise, these traditional ways of thinking about history would say that these areas would see the least organizing because they were these mobile work camps, right? Yet the history of the strike itself shows that wasn't the case. These the cannery union and the strikes that happened at the 33 Berry strike was organized against these currents and against the immediate aftermath of the repatriation drives and the immediate aftermath of the Great Depression, really at the height of the Great Depression. It was part of a larger wave of strikes that went through Southern California and then Northern California that summer, culminating in strikes in the San Joaquin Valley. It was part of a larger strikes movement that went on from there. Hicks Camp continued to be a place, even after the defeat of these organizing efforts. People continued to live there, and through the 1950s, it became a major source of bracero workers coming to live there. By then, there was a second or perhaps third generation of people who had grown up in these camps, and they began to take on a more sense of being a permanent community there. A lot of the interviews we did were with people who had grown up in the camps as they existed in the 40s and 1950s, where they saw camps that were both more permanent than before, more permanent housing, perhaps gravel roads, but still outside of the political economy of the area, not necessarily integrated into the city of Amonte or integrated into Southern California in the larger sense of the term. In starting in the 40s, but really accelerating in the 1950s, it was efforts for urban redevelopment. And often these unincorporated towns became the target of this, right? And the creation of freeways, the creation of suburbs, the redevelopment of the land tried to push out these communities the way they exist. And eventually that's what happened to Hicks Camp, as well as some of the others. But that's not what happened to all of the camps. Some places did a more gradual transition into a regular neighborhood of the city. In many of those cases, there was quite a bit of displacement as well. But people remembered what life was like in these camps, and they kept meeting with each other. They kept forms of community alive. In the case of El Monte, that meant the La Historia Society, which became sort of a depository of a lot of these lived experiences in these places. And for me, it was very important to recast that history not as just a lost history, something that came before the creation of the modern suburb, but really something that was central to the creation of California and its history and what it became the years afterwards.
Exactly. I think, and that's very much, I think, how you know, you see it as you understand more and more, right? The role and the place of Colonia, Barrio Formation. I mean, that, you know, you mentioned so many things there. I mean, that the type of segregation, the type of urban planning, the type of, you know, intentional municipal, you know, neglect that goes into all of it. I mean, this is a key story to not just Greater El Monte, but to Southern California broadly. I mean, to a lot of parts of, you know, the West, particularly the Southwest, what we call Greater Mexico. Stacy, how about your piece? If particularly, you know, the story around Sugar Shack, you know, how does that not only reshape the history of Greater El Monte, but also, I mean, the region itself?
Sure. I think the thing that the Sugar Shack piece does as a result of having been able to find folks to speak to directly and pair that with the official documentation through the city clerk in El Monte was realizing this longer history of self-identified gay women and men. And I use gay explicitly, as that's how many of the folks that I spoke with identified themselves. A longer history of gay community formation within the east of East LA areas that involve relationships to bars outside of El Monte and South El Monte, but also connect them in a way that, sorry, I lost my mic. That connect them in a way that we wouldn't originally have imagined, because we think of perhaps those bars, Reds in Boyle Heights and Plush Pony in El Sereno, East LA. We think of those as the bars that sit on the outer limits of West Hollywood. So West Hollywood as the main gay LA, historically, the place that attracts the most gay tourists or locals, you know, from all over. So to resituate El Monte and the Sugar Shack in relationship not to West Hollywood, but to these two bars, East LA and El Sereno, it gives us a different glimpse into a community and a history that often is on the fringe, and it doesn't start with them. So I thought that was a really important piece, an important as a result of getting this name, the East Side Circle, that one of the interviewees was able to pluck from her memory and say it, share it with such authority that this was their route. The East Side Circle route that they took was pretty astounding to me, that there was a set of cultural practices, a set of places that were queer, that were Chicano, Latino, Latina specific, that didn't, where West Hollywood didn't even really enter their imagination. So it really shifts the map, like literally shifts it. And the starting point then becomes these locations that often get looked at in the aftermath or the afterthought. It's kind of like when you listen to NPR or a local radio station, and they say they're giving a recommendation for a restaurant or a theater or play or a site. And they say, but you have to go all the way out to the east side. You have to go all the way out to the 605 freeway. You have to take the 60, right? So you already know that they're positioned and imagining their listener as situated in the west side. And so looking at these stories and the the group of women that I was able to speak to, who generously shared with me their history, they were already starting from the East Side. And I think that is one of the contributions or one of the interventions that their history provides.
Thank you. It's reading your chapter, Stacey, made me think so much about the importance of place, in the development of people's culture, of their identities, of how we build relationships, you know, that have such deep meaning. I mean, the subtitle includes the title itself is, you know, a gay bar, some familia, and Latina butch femme. And really, that's so much what place does for us, right? It creates, you know, a ground upon which relationships can be built, upon which deep meanings and associations can be established. So I really appreciated how you paint that picture for us, and again, try to help us to, mentally map and see the world as it existed for these women, at least in regards to their social practices and, their attempts to, again, not just understand themselves, but to really just build relationships. Just a phenomenal job at that.
Thank you. And if I can just interject one last thing, that part of the intervention that I think I was really invested in attempting to provide as well into these narratives around the gay bar, the requisite gay bar, right, as this premier locale that gay people find and build alternative familia in, is that what was so essential and what I think needs to be understood and researched further is that biological family is important to queer of color communities. And these communities are often cast as already always homophobic, transphobic, that they don't have any tolerance for sexual and gender difference or sexual and gender non-normativity. And for as long as I worked in these communities, it has always been the case that biological family, moms, tias, cousins, brothers, you name it, have actually been included in some of the social activities, some of the cultural practices of these queer LGBT identified people. And that is such an important piece of our history that I think often gets written out of the story of our communities, or also imagined as our familias have already cast us out, right? We've betrayed them via our sexuality and our gender, so they're not involved in our lives. And so these women affirmed again and again how essential biological families were to constructing their social lives. So it was both sets of families. And I just really wanted to emphasize that.
No, thank you for making that point. I think that is so crucial, right? I think in regards to reshaping, again, that narrative, particularly that is told about, you know, ethnic communities, you know, communities of color and their response, you know, to the LGBTQ community. That it's just much more complex, you know, right? The broader narrative that gets told, you know, is mostly of people that have, you know, stuck in traditional culture and are intolerant, right, of, of family members that don't fit a mold, when it's all histories, all people are so much more complicated, you know, than that. So
absolutely.
Definitely. Thank you. Thank you for making that point and for bringing that out and for having that as part of this important chapter and project. Well, I hate to have to wrap this up, but I promised all of you I'd try to keep us on time. I do want to give just each of you a minute, if you wouldn't mind telling us, you know, moving forward, what are, you know, some other projects? What's the next thing that you're working on? Obviously, this book was just published, so you're you know, as much as you can, are trying to promote it within the constraints of COVID-19 and the coronavirus. But what else do y'all got going on right now? Maybe let's start with you, Romeo, and then we'll move on to Stacey and Daniel.
Yeah, well, thanks for having us. Appreciate you making the effort, particularly as everyone struggles to to balance life again, right? Life and work. I would just, so this has nothing to do with my like academic work in the sense that it doesn't overlap with my dissertation. It's in the lab with my research. So perhaps I'll just talk a little bit more about the way we imagine the book. And you know, we open or we in the introduction, there's this whole thing about talent in the past and the ways in which power and talent is at work within history. And a big goal of the project has really been to center community throughout the historical process. So the community is supposed to be at the center of the archive building, the storytelling, and also trying to find radical new ways to experience both primary and secondary sources. So in that sense, the book may be done, but the project's not done. So one of the goals moving forward is to work with educators to integrate the book into the curriculum at the local high school. We started doing some of that work, but also to find new ways to share these histories and these stories. And I think my return to LA, our return to LA, me and Caribbean, will really help us to further think about how should this book exist in our community. So a big part of what's next for me is to revamp the digital website, sort of upload everything, to start really working with local community members to get this book into the schools and to the colleges.
Thank you for that. And I think that's such an important part of not just, I mean, that's obviously the around the origins of this project. I mean, it's not as if this, right, you know, CMAP, you know, originated, I don't know, you can tell me, you can correct me with it originated with the idea of creating an academic book. That was probably something that happened later, right? This is much more of a community focused approach, but my bigger thought is, I think it's just more of the importance of, you know, these narratives to, you know, the community and being used indeed in the K-12 curriculum, which, you know, is very much accessible. I think the, not just the length of the essays, you know, they're brief, but they are in depth, you know, and so I think there's something in there for a lot of folk, whether it's just community members, whether it's, you know, at the K-12 educational setting, or if it's in academia, there's very much several ways in which I think this particular work can be used. And as you mentioned, the project continuing to grow. So I'm very much glad to hear about that. Stacey?
So the projects that I'm working on right now are, I would call them like sister projects to this. And originally I was looking at representations of queer of color, in particular queer Latino Chicano representations in popular media, in film, in literature. And one of the sites where I was looking at this work is in the work by Adelina Anthony in her film Bruising for Vessels. So in that film, she prioritizes looking at a relationship between a woman who is from San Antonio and comes to live in LA and has this traumatic history, but finds community locally in Los Angeles. And so part of what that film captured was the necessity to highlight our stories increasingly through whether it's film or literature, or other cultural arts forms to keep doing that. And so writing about that was a way to also bring more visibility to the work that she and other cultural artists are making, either visually or through film. So the sister projects that have grown, though, out of the Sugar Shack piece that were inspired by originally looking at Adelina Anthony's Bruising for Vessels film, because it took place in East LA and there's a lesbian bar scene, you know, a lot of these lesbian bars are closed, or actually I don't really think that one exists anymore, maybe traveling sites. So Reds and Plush Pony would be added to that list. They both closed within the past 5-7 years. I've been having challenges finding information about them. The Sugar Shack was actually in some ways easier to find information on. And I don't know if in part it's because it's within the city of El Monte, you know, smaller city, less bureaucracy to tend to. But I'm working on looking to do some sort of the same storytelling that I did with the Sugar Shack piece with the Reds and Plush Pony, which are, again, these two bars that exist more firmly in our imagination publicly. And yet there's little written. There's practically nothing about them. Laura Aguilar, the photographer, who famously photographed a plush pony club attendees in this beautiful series, and who tragically passed about 2 years ago, and had her work shown at the Vincent Price Art Museum in East LA, connected to East LA City College. She perhaps is one of the few that documents the actual club goers, but there's nothing about the places themselves. So I'm really trying to dig up some of that material now.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. Daniel, your work?
Thank you. Well, the CIMAC project is definitely continuing. We've been working on building up the website, getting more interviews up, and we hope to, we have a lot more material than we've been able to put up onto the website, but our hope is to turn the website into a portal in which people could access interviews and documents, and begin to make use of it themselves, not only the curated essays that we have here, but to go in there and write and make new interpretations of the past. This work was not original, was originally separate from my dissertation and not included in there, but it's ended up shaping my academic trajectory enough that I went back and have really done a lot of major rewriting of my work in incorporating and expanding on a lot of the work that we did here. And to that end, I'm in the process of finishing up a monograph on the creation of the structures that guide and shape migration from Mexico to the United States in the early 20th century. The last thing that I'm working on is the where you work ends up shaping what you do going forward. And in that case, I had no intention or no originally no intention of working in Virginia. But now that I'm here, I've realized, wait, there's a very large Latino community in Virginia, which came as a very pleasant surprise when I came to work in Harrisonburg. And that's really become a lot of my life in the past 3 years, where I've worked with in collaboration with other faculty at James Madison University, especially in anthropology, sociology, and political science. And communication and working with the Latino and immigrant community there to create the project Immigrant Harrisonburg, which is a large public initiative. It's both public history, but also public outreach to other communities in assisting people in their stories, as well as empowering community members to shape the way in which they speak back to academia. And that project's continuing, and we're hoping to expand it to other parts of Virginia.
Great. Thank you for that. And I just wanted to real quickly plug, because you've mentioned the website a few times. Romeo, what's the, can you give us the exact website? Is that this one that I'm seeing, the cmartsposse.wordpress.com? Is that the one that's being referred
that's
to?
That's a WordPress that is embarrassing because we haven't published anything in decades. the digital archive, which is sort of in progress right now, and it doesn't quite overlap with the book, but the idea is that it'll overlap with the way in which the book is organized so that folks can sort of go and look at different sections, different exhibits. So theoretically, at some point, we'll work with Stacey to really document some of those stories and maybe expand on them, and they can be in the archive as well. But the current digital website that exists right now is just cmapeastofeast.com. So S-E-M-A-P, okay. eastofeast.com. And I'd say that maybe like 30% of the material is up there, but there are some oral histories. And again, the idea is that when folks use this or when they want to use this launching pad, they can read the book, dive into the archive, or vice versa, dive into the archive and then dive into the book.
Great. Great. Well, Romeo, Stacy, Daniel, thank all three of you. Thank you again for coming on to New Books Latino Studies, for sharing. I just think this great transformative work, truly, I think, radical in several ways, but very important. I mean, so thank you again for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.